Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from recent and archived issues of the journal. I'm Megan Pipe, and this month, I dive into the archives to read Jennifer Eitel's Moonwalk. The essay appears in the fall-winter 2017 issue of the journal. Stay tuned. Moonwalk by Jennifer Eitel. 1. I've been walking almost daily around a lake that's drying up. Or rather, it's being slowly drained. It has something to do with a leak that needs fixing. It's a man-made lake, and there's a dam made of boulders on one side, and the fixers can't do what they need to do until the lake is empty. It's becoming less and less scenic, but since I like routine, and the lake is just up the street from my son's elementary school, I haven't found a new route. Alex is in second grade, and I've been walking twice around this lake slash soon-to-be puddle every school day, except for rainy or abrasively windy days, since Alex was in kindergarten. At first, at the start of the school year, I didn't realize the draining was purposeful. I just registered that the water was getting lower, and then alarmingly lower. There were fewer birds, and the air around the lake started to smell faintly of rotting fish. Another walker filled me in on what was going on, how the lake had to be drained slowly so the birds could eat the fish slowly and then fly away. Apparently, if you drain a lake suddenly, you've got a real stinking mess. Also, there's the practical matter of all that water at once. Where would it go? So the lake is shrinking, and the birds have gone elsewhere, and so have the coyotes. Last winter and the one before, a pair of coyotes would sometimes trot through the trees alongside the water. I would keep an eye on them, and they on me. And if this went on long enough, I would wonder, since I was walking in circles, who was following whom. There are fewer walkers, too, since on the windy days, the wind swoops the dry lake bed up and deposits it in stretches here and there along the trail, so the walking along those parts feels like walking in several inches of moon dirt. Or, at any rate, that's how I've come to think of those dusty patches, since there's a feeling of desolation about the place now. 2. The draining of the lake happened to coincide with the growing of a lump in my belly area. Possibly, the lump had been growing for some time, but during these months happened to grow large enough for me to become aware of it. I couldn't pinpoint its exact location, and I didn't know what it was. At first, I thought stomach cancer, then bladder cancer, then uterine cancer. Then finally, after several nights of a severe pain in my side that turned my imaginary cancer from strangely comforting to startlingly real, I went to see my doctor, who said the lump was in my uterus and was a fibroid. Or most likely a fibroid. "You'll need to get an ultrasound to be sure," she said, "but I'll bet you a nickel you've got fibroid disease." She said it happily, as if looking forward to her nickel. I wanted to say, if you're going to bet your patients, you might want to up your ante. Betting a nickel made her sound old. But I didn't say it. Instead, I asked about the pain in my side that had woken me for several nights running, then disappeared as soon as I sat up, and then, after a week, disappeared altogether. My doctor shook her head. "Your uterus is here," she said, touching my lump. "And you're saying the pain was here. I can't make a story out of that." I went for the ultrasound, and the results were sent to my narratively challenged doctor, who called to say that I most definitely had a fibroid. Harmless, but the size of a baseball. Tactfully, she didn't mention her nickel, but she did suggest a hysterectomy. "You don't have to get one," she said, "but you might be more comfortable without that big lump inside you." Before incorrectly diagnosing myself with some type of central body cancer, I thought I was entering menopause. I'd been walking around a drying up lake and harboring the thought that I was drying up too. Not just creatively. For months I hadn't been writing, but also reproductively, though I was bleeding a lot. But I'd understood that to mean I was on my way to drying up, like the lake. I liked the synchronicity. It was a shock to learn I'd been telling myself a false story. 3. Once the lake is no longer and heavy machinery is on the scene, I find myself humming the Beatles song, Fixing a Hole, when I pass by the men working on the leak down at the base of the boulders. Though I guess, technically, they're not fixing a hole when the rain gets in, but fixing a dam where the rain gets out. The drained lake looks like a moon crater. The bulldozers are moon rovers, and I might be the only one still walking the path that circles where the lake once was. Which is fitting, perhaps, because within me, something vital has slipped away. My desire to write. After years and years of writing fiction, of finding solace in it, I've stopped seeing the point. Sometimes on my walks, a new story idea flits through my head, but I let it go. I think, why bother? My stories aren't true, and few people read them. They are trees made of air, falling in a lonely forest. Instead of going home to my desk, I do an extra lap or veer off on a path that leads up a grassy hill. From there, the view is stark, but somehow beautiful in its starkness. What I'm struck by, I suppose, is absence. I think of Buzz Aldrin stepping onto the moon after Neil Armstrong in 1969 and surveying the seemingly waterless, lifeless landscape. Beautiful view, he said. Then, a moment later, magnificent desolation. 4. During a stretch of cold days, a sheet of snow settles in the depression where the lake used to be and glints in the sun, so it looks like the lake has come back. I take my husband and son there on a Sunday morning to show them. It's been a weekend of bickering. Alex is too hyper for the house that contains him, and my husband and I are bored of winter and bored, truth be told, with each other. It's one of those mornings when I wake and think, if we don't shake ourselves out of this, we're done for. So I cajole us into the car, and we drive to the lake. Since I'm itching for exercise, I walk around at my usual pace while my husband and son venture across, and as they near the middle, they look like prophets walking on water, then like strangers, insignificant and unknowable, then like the two beings I care about most in the world, tiptoeing across the surface of the unknown, and I panic and think, I am the one who sent them forth. Then I hurry around the arc of the lake bed to meet them. 5. The thing is, I don't need my uterus. It's become cumbersome, and I'm 46 and not going to have another child. And two friends who had hysterectomies because of fibroids have told me they are much more comfortable now. Still, I haven't scheduled the surgery. This is in part because I've grown friendly with my lump. At night, lying on my back, I cut my hand around it, my secret baby baseball, and try to figure out what it means. Medically, not much. My body has formed a benign mass of muscle cells and connective tissue. But what if it has deeper meaning? Maybe it's a physical manifestation of my recent creative rut. My apathy about writing was one of the things I'd mistakenly attributed to menopause, but now I find myself wondering if my fibroid is the culprit, if it's not a useless mass at all, but a tightly spooled knot of unrealized work. Maybe my body is harboring a complicated, spectacular story, one that nobody, not even my doctor, can decipher. During the months when the lake was receding, it revealed things. A tire, a 5-gallon bucket, a broken wooden crate, a baseball. When I spotted the baseball, I decided to pluck it out of the muck for Alex. It had a split seam, revealing its spooled insides, which is what I wanted to show him. I'd heard somewhere that a baseball contains a mile of thread, which means an unspooled baseball would loop once around my lake. Maybe my fibroid is the result of walking around the lake too many times, or of walking in circles too many times throughout my entire life. Literally, but also, the same pattern to my days, the same arguments, not just with my husband or Alex, who argues everything these days, but with myself, maybe especially with myself, the same doubts and insecurities looping and looping. Maybe if I spend the second half of my life walking backward, I will unspool, release whatever it is that has wrapped up tightly inside me. Maybe I've arrived, not at menopause, but middle age. According to my doctor, my fibroid will likely start to shrink when I truly start menopause. Maybe this is all menopause is, come to think of it, the beginning of walking backward. 6. One day in early spring, When the snow is gone, but nothing has yet turned green, I stop walking and look at the barren landscape and think, what am I doing here? There are no birds or coyotes or people in sight. I wonder where all the other walkers are. Have they found a better place to go? 7. My doctor suggested I see a gynecologist for a second opinion, so I did. My husband took the morning off to go with me. The gynecologist was friendly and chatty. She said lots of women have fibroids. Some have them and don't even know it. Some fibroids grow out of control, to the size of cantaloupes, or, in one particularly unusual case, up behind a woman's rib cage, making it hard for her to breathe. The gynecologist said she had fibroids too, and if she weren't so busy with her practice, she'd get a hysterectomy. She seemed to feel no attachment to her uterus. She just couldn't spare the time off after surgery to rest. Eventually, we circled back to my body. She studied my ultrasound results, talked to us about the pros and cons of surgery in my case, and then said something along the lines of, I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to answer immediately. Do you want a hysterectomy? No, I said. Okay, she said. Then for now, don't get one. She suggested an IUD to ebb the bleeding, or to eventually ebb the bleeding. She said the IUD might cause me to bleed daily, but only lightly, for up to 6 months. After that, I wouldn't bleed much at all. So the IUD would cause either a draining or a damming. I didn't entirely understand, but thought it sounded worth a try. Another reason she suggested the IUD was birth control. When she asked us about our method in her initial Q&A, my husband glanced at me and then said, "We're risk takers." Then, because it struck us as such an inaccurate description of ourselves and our marriage in general, this is what ran through my mind, and I'm assuming my husband's too. We fell into a fit of laughter, and the gynecologist sat smiling and shaking her head, probably thinking us the wildest, happiest couple on earth. When we calmed down, she wanted to know why we hadn't been bothering with birth control. Teenagers and 40-somethings are the worst, she said. And I had to explain that I hadn't been worried about it because I'd mistakenly thought myself menopausal. We left, buoyed from laughing together, and I felt relieved that the gynecologist had given me permission to hold on to my uterus for a little bit longer. 8. It's not just that I've grown friendly with my lump, or that, under our insurance plan, it would cost a huge chunk of money to remove it. I want to keep my uterus because it was my son's first home, the place where he was safest, and even though he can't come back to it when he needs a break from the world, I like knowing it's there, a childhood house I'll never sell or renovate or knock to the ground. I want to keep it because removing it might leave a strange crater or displace the ghosts of all the children I never had, who were never conceived, because I was busy with other things, because life slips by. I want to keep my uterus because, at 46, I've likely reached the middle and enough has already been taken. Nothing crucial, but little bits and pieces of me. My eyesight, which is waning, my teeth, which have been ground down, and my breasts, my once plump breasts. Where did they go? Even my pee betrays. I sneeze and it tries to escape. And that's just the tangible. What about the intangible? My self-confidence. That was a thing once, a part of my body. It's been chipped away. My weight. Not my actual body weight, but my sense of self, my heft, my ambition, by which I mean not just the stories I've yet to write, but my own story, the story of me, which was supposed to be an adventure. I cannot be reduced any further. You cannot take my fibroid, my baseball, the fist clenched in the middle of me, refusing to reveal. How is it that, after all these years, someone could look at me and voice a fear I didn't even know was there? I can't make a story out of that. On the other hand, fuck it. Cut me open. Take away all that is heavy. 9. Once, I was a risk taker. Or rather, for a handful of years when I was young, I did some risky and adventurous things. In high school, a friend and I road tripped to Grateful Dead concerts, lived out of the back of her Toyota station wagon, took acid, saw the world in fresh light, refused sleep, didn't wash our hair for days. Once, I fell in love and lived for a summer in Berkeley, California with my beloved, in a room in a house near the top of a hill overlooking the San Francisco Bay. I got a job there painting houses with a crew of men because I wanted to work outside and do something that wasn't ordinary or expected of me. Once, with the same boyfriend, I spent a summer in Ketchum, Idaho. There, I worked with a different crew of painters. I painted the outside of condos that faced a golf course in Sun Valley, and men in golf carts yelled up at me, "Be careful, honey, on that ladder!" On weekends, we hitchhiked to towns we wanted to see and to trailheads, and once we got lost overnight in the Sawtooths. Once, in the desert, we witnessed a lunar eclipse, and because we were so young with such bright futures before us, it didn't snuff our own glow or make us feel insignificant. Once, at summer's end, I rode a Greyhound bus across the country by myself. Once, I thought repetition was avoidable. I said I'd live in all 50 states before I died. I left home and forgot to look back. Once, I went to one of the states and stayed. I made friends, found work, built a life. I got married, then pregnant. My belly grew hard and round like a globe. Then my son came out and became my world. 10. I have a friend I've been hiking with for close to 20 years. She's also a writer. Usually we meet on the weekends in the foothills west of Denver. But sometimes we go on longer hikes, and once, deep in the Rocky Mountains, we came upon a goat with curled horns. It was tucked in a cave-like dip in a rock wall alongside the trail, eating whatever was growing there. We stopped a safe distance away, unsure what to do. We could either stay on the trail and walk right by the goat, or we could walk in a wide arc to give it space, but that would put us close to a cliff's edge, and what if the grazing goat happened to look up and see us and charge? We deliberated until a couple of runners, two young guys, appeared behind us. "There's a mountain goat eating right up ahead," we told them. "Cool," they said. They barely slowed as they ran by the goat, and my friend and I looked at each other and laughed, then wondered. Had they been too brash, or we too timid? We've hiked through everything. Windstorms, snow, rain. Pregnancies, fights with our husbands, drama with our kids, doubts about our writing. We always, in some way, come around to our writing. We talk through ideas, talk about the ways in which we are stuck. Sometimes, we despair. One of us decides there is no point in wrestling with sentences or shaping plots, and the other gives a pep talk. We laugh about how predictable we are. Like me, my friend prefers a circular route, and since we tend to pick a loop and walk it for years, we laugh about the fact that we're talking about the same thing we talked about a week ago or a month ago in the very same spot. Once, I joked that the dirt we tread over and over again has probably absorbed our words, so when future walkers pass, without understanding why, they'll feel in our feet our woes and worries, our hopes, our elations. Sometimes, when it doesn't work out for us to hike together and I'm walking one of our trails alone, our conversations seep up and I think, it's good I stayed. 11. During their 2.5-hour walk on the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin didn't see any water. The 10 astronauts who walked on the moon after them, during various missions, didn't see any either. Because there wasn't any to see, but also, perhaps, because they didn't stick around long enough to truly get to know their landscape. They were under time constraints. And, well, oxygen constraints. They were making giant leaps, but had to be quick about it. They noted the magnificent desolation, gathered samples, headed back to Earth. But water was there. Is there. When water on the moon was finally confirmed in 2009, 40 years after the first moon landing, Seth Borenstein, an Associated Press writer versed in the language of science, opened an article with these poetic and somewhat eerie lines. "The moon isn't the dry, dull place it seems. Traces of water lurk in the dirt unseen." Not visible, but there nonetheless. On the moon, There is approximately one drink of water per baseball field-sized patch of moon dirt, which might raise the question, so what? One could still die of thirst on the moon. But think of it this way, a drink waiting in a field, a mile hiding in a baseball, a story biding time in a body. 12. Here's the thing about walking in circles, about looping, about routine. You see everything in different lights, different slants, different seasons. You see it all. You're there when one day, after a spring rain, there's a puddle where a parched lake bed once was. You notice before others that the snow in the mountains is melting and trickling down. It hasn't fully returned yet, my lake. It hasn't reached the trees that line the side where the birds nest. But soon enough it will, and the birds will come back, and then the coyotes. Another month, maybe, and the water will creep up around the trees so that the trunks are submerged. What's holding them up will disappear for a while. It will look as if the trees are floating, surreal, a feat of nature in a mostly ordinary suburb. And I will be the first to see it. You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast. Subscribe on iTunes or find us on the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.